Assalamu alaikum och hjärtligt välkommen till Koranpodden. Detta är podcasten som hjälper dig förstå Allahs ord och där vi träffar spännande personer och samtalar med dem om Koranen över en kopp kaffe. Jag heter Sally och du lyssnar på säsong 3, poddavsnitt 111. Idag ska du få lyssna på mitt samtal tillsammans med Alex Sabur. Född i Iran, uppväxt i USA och flyttade som tonåring till Köpenhamn. Han har gjort en fantastisk livsresa som berör och inspirerar. Men innan du ska få lyssna på mitt samtal tillsammans med Alex så vill jag spela upp ett kort ljudmeddelande från Firdaus om Koranpodden och hennes önskemål.
Assalamu alaikum broder Sally. Jag vill tacka dig extremt mycket för den här fina podden och det otroliga arbete du gör. Det betyder väldigt mycket för mig och för många andra att kunna lära oss mer om vår religion, kunna utveckla oss till bättre muslimer och medmänniskor. Jag hade velat höra lite mer om hur vi via Koranen och Islam och Sunna skulle kunna lära oss om exempelvis att bli bättre partners, bättre barn, att bygga hållbara relationer helt enkelt. Också hur man kan använda religionen till att skapa både fysisk och psykisk hälsa, god hälsa och motarbeta ohälsa. Tack!
Hållbara relationer. Så vackert och perfekt formulerat, mashallah. Att stärka våra relationer med våra familjemedlemmar, arbetskollegor och vänner är något som vi verkligen behöver arbeta med och något som vår religion understryker gång på gång som något centralt och viktigt för vår tro. Jag har nedtecknat ditt önskemål Firdaus i min arbetsbok och tar med mig det i mitt framtida arbete. Beträffande det där med att motverka psykisk ohälsa är naturligtvis också superviktigt och jag kan redan avslöja att jag har spelat in ett längre samtal om detta som jag kommer släppa lite längre fram under säsong 3, inshallah. Vanessa som också skrev till mig om Koranpodden och hennes önskemål berör också detta ämnesområde om psykisk ohälsa i sitt meddelande till mig, skriver Vanessa. Salamu alaikum. Koranpodden är sjukt bra, mashallah. Dels för att det tas upp så mycket som man egentligen inte har tänkt och sånt som är bra att veta. När man själv inte hinner söka efter denna information på grund av olika anledningar så är det superbra att man kan lyssna på dig, Sally. På vägen till jobbet och även hem från jobbet. När man kanske har en dålig dag så har du flera avsnitt som gör en glad. I säsong 3 kan man kanske ta upp om djup depression eller att ens iman inte är på topp. Hur ska man hantera detta med tanke på hur världen ser ut idag? Må Allah belöna dig för att du gör detta. Slutcitat. Tack Vanessa för dina uppmuntrande ord och för dina tips. Jag tar med mig dina önskemål. Samtidigt så vill jag tipsa om min distansutbildning som man enkelt kan ladda ner till datorn eller mobiltelefonen. Kursen heter Botemedel mot sorg och ångest och går att laddas ner via aktivmuslim.se. I denna kurs ger jag konkreta och praktiska tips på hur du kan stärka din mentala hälsa. Kursen bygger på inspirerande textkällor ur Koranen och profeten Muhammeds uttalanden. Över honom var Guds frid, men också på modern forskning. Direktlänken till distanskursen Botemedel mot sorg och ångest hittar du på koranpodden.se/111. Okej, tillbaks till mitt samtal och intervju med Alex Sabur i Köpenhamn. I mitt samtal med Alex berättar han om sin uppväxt i USA och om omställningen när han flyttade till sin pappa i Köpenhamn. Alex berättar om hur han konverterade till islam 2014 och hur han i samband med detta lämnade en framgångsrik karriär inom musikbranschen. Alex startade istället den mycket framgångsrika mediebyrån Gorilla Media som han driver idag med iver och framgång, mashallah. Vi pratar om Guerrilla Media och om Guerrilla Medias korta YouTube-video som heter Jag är dansk, som blev Danmarks mest virala video någonsin och som berör frågan om vem som avgör, vem som är dansk och vem som avgör vem som inte är dansk. Vi avrundar till sist samtalet med att Alex berättar om hur han förlorade sin son Adam vid 3 månaders ålder och hur Koranen blev en tröst för honom. Mycket rörande och stärkande berättelse. Så luta dig tillbaka, höj volymen och låt dig inspireras av mitt samtal med Alex Sabur, som är fast besluten att använda alla sina kunskaper och färdigheter för att motverka intolerans och rasism.
Originally, what actually happened was that I'm sitting here eating cookies. Are recording this?
I'm recording, bro.
Okay. Sorry, everybody. To my defense, they're really good cookies.
Yeah, mashallah. It looks like Swedish cookies, or are they Danish? I don't know.
They're Danish, I think. What was the question?
Who's gonna publish the book?
Or? I don't know. The thing is that generally when I do stuff, it gets picked up.
Okay.
And in this case, the reason why, I mean, I did the I Am Danish film, and that came out, and immediately what occurred was that I was getting phone calls and emails from teachers telling me that, hey, we have kids, 4-year-old kids, 5-year-old kids, and all of them were just in doubt about how do we speak about nationality and ethnicity with young children. And when I asked them, I was like, well, isn't there a book? You know, you start some type of, you know, dialogue, read a book, and then take it from there. Yeah. And they said no. And with a little research, I found out there is no book in Denmark that discusses nationality or ethnicity in this way.
For young kids.
For young kids. So then I just said, if it doesn't exist, I'm going to make it myself.
I like that mindset. You know, I'm going to do it myself. That's how the Quran pod started. Like, I was looking around. There's no pod for Muslims in Sweden that where we discuss and have our own platform. So I'm like, I'm going to start myself. So that's how it started. Alex, it's a real privilege for me and an honor to be able to be here in your beautiful office.
Oh, bro, very inspiring. Thank you.
And, you know, I've seen your work. And so I'm really looking forward to talk to you about your videos and your work. But also to have a focus, because I've seen some interviews.
Yeah.
But to have focus on your spiritual journey.
Yeah.
Because you converted to Islam.
I did.
So let's start from the beginning. You're born in Iran.
I was born in Iran, 1984, 35 years old today.
Yeah.
I come from a family. My grandparents are Shia Muslims on both sides, and my parents were not Muslim at all.
Yeah.
I was one when we moved from, I was with my mom, we moved to Los Angeles.
You have any memories of that or from
none,
Iran?
Nothing at all.
Yeah.
And arrive in America in Los Angeles in 1985, and with a young mom. My mom, I think she was 21 years old, and couldn't speak a word of English and was just a child of the ghetto in Los Angeles, where we stayed for many years.
Yeah. So how was it growing up in L.A.?
Southern California is a beautiful place.
Yeah.
It's a really, I mean, to begin with, subhanAllah, it's just the nature there is so incredible.
Yeah.
In the 1980s and early 90s in America was a very unique time. Culturally, the pop culture, the things that we were experiencing, the race riots, the O.J. Simpson trial.
Yeah, I remember that.
These are really important things that were a part of my childhood.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, just this overwhelming identity of being American. And I always joke about it today because I'm not actually American in terms of my citizenship. The entire time I was living in America, I was actually an illegal immigrant in America. I was an illegal alien. But if you were to ask me where I'm from, then I would tell you America.
Yeah.
Because it was just that type of society in the 80s that was very inclusive. And I never heard anyone mention the word Muslim in a public forum, let alone ever question my American identity my entire time that I was there.
So you grew up there, and how was religion? We were walking here to the office, and you told me that you grew up in a very Christian environment.
Definitely. I mean, the city, as my mom got more educated, we were able to then get out of the ghetto and move into a much nicer neighborhood. And I was raised predominantly in a very white evangelical Christian community called Mission Viejo, and in that part of Orange County. It's just outside of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And I mean, I remember going to church. I've gone to church. I was go to Sunday service.
With
not,
your mom?
Not with my mom.
Just with your friends?
Just with my friends. Yeah.
Cool.
I remember so clearly being gifted a Bible a few times, few occasions. And having that kind of evangelical Christian, which is very different from the Protestant Christian communities that we see here in Denmark. Evangelical Christians are very outward. They're very God-loving. You know, you always say grace at the table.
Did you count yourself as a Christian then when you were...
Nah, never that. Absolutely never thought myself as a Christian. I would always consider myself to be spiritual, but I hated religion. I saw religion as a form of control, and especially because later on my mom found... I don't want to call it Islam, but it's a form of Islamic Sufism, if we can use that term very loosely. She became a member of that community, and I hated it. I was forced to go to these meetings. I was forced to go to their schools, and I just found religion in all ways to be against the very nature of the human being. Yeah. This is me at a young age, right? 12, 13, reflecting on this. And so I became very anti-religious and felt myself to be very, I mean, a person who would laugh at people with faith for the majority of my teenage years. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you still attended church, or was this like before?
I started. I definitely stopped going to any kind of religious functions, of any nature after that.
MashaAllah. And then you moved from the U.S. to Denmark, Copenhagen.
That was a big change.
What made you move?
My dad lived in Denmark, so I had this opportunity to visit my dad. My relationship with my mom was very strained, and that was it. So I had this beautiful opportunity to just come to this strange place. I thought Denmark was in Canada.
You know, my wife is from US, from Jersey. Yeah. And when I married her, I mean, we got in touch through a mutual friend.
Yeah.
But, and I remember when we talked on the phone, and, you know, I introduced myself. I talked to her for the first time, and she's like, "Where do you live?" I'm like, "In Sweden." So Sweden for her was like, she didn't know anything about it, but she's like, "I'm coming over, I'm gonna meet you, I wanna see you," you know? And then she eventually moved to Sweden, and a lot of questions she gets as an American is like, "What did you move to Sweden? What do you wanna do here? You know, America, you have all the opportunities, the American dream." And so, I mean, you leave America and come to Denmark, another language, small country.
Yeah. I mean, it was complicated because I was very young when I made that decision.
Yeah.
So I was thinking more on the along the lines that, you know, I had a very strange relationship with my mom. I didn't like my stepdad. I could have that opportunity to basically have some freedom in Denmark and meet my dad, who I'd never known. And at the same time, I was very well aware that my mom would not have the financial means to send me to university. So that was a decision that was made there. In hindsight, it's a really good question to ask about why would people come to Europe versus going to America. And it's absolutely true that the American dream does exist.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go to America and you can make millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars. There's no ceiling to capitalism.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we tend to forget. And when you look around, you tend to very, very quickly forget that there's tens of thousands of homeless people in all the major cities. That there is injustice everywhere you look in America. And those are just on the East and West Coast. the majority of Americans never travel into heartland America to see the absolute devastation and poverty that people live in. So the American dream definitely did exist at some point. But I think with the wealth inequality that we're seeing today, it no longer really exists. I think that the American dream is probably more alive in Sweden and in Denmark than it is in America.
So when how old were you when you came to?
I was 14.
14.
Yeah.
So how was it? How did you feel when you came to a new country like that?
It was very different because I came from a evangelical Christian society upper class white people who lived this very protected American lifestyle. People drank when they were 21. People didn't smoke. And the day that I think was the same week I came to Denmark,
yeah.
I was 14 and I, you know, we didn't live in a particularly nice neighborhood, but you know,
started over from the ghetto.
I was in the ghetto with my dad again. We were in, it's a well-known ghetto here in Copenhagen,
okay.
But I was over there, and had my first beer and was smoking cigarettes.
Yeah.
And this is at 14. So it was a very huge and very awkward jump. To experience that.
Was it liberating?
It was liberating. It was very interesting. I mean, when you suddenly go from not having any freedom and everything is forbidden for you to then suddenly you're in a place with absolutely no supervision because my dad didn't watch me at all. And you're in this society where alcohol is readily available and kids smoke and et cetera, et cetera.
You know,
it was a culture shock.
As a Swede, it's a cultural shock to come to Denmark and see the alcohol. You know, like I was here with my son for an event and it was late. It was like maybe 8, 9 in the evening. We were standing by the bus stop and all of a sudden it comes, you know, Danish youngsters and they're like having vodkas in their hands and bottles and they were just drinking by the bus stop. You never see that in Sweden, in Malmo, you know?
No.
So it's another cultural. And a lot of Swedes talk about that. Oh, let's take the train over to Copenhagen, Denmark and just drink and get... Yeah.
Denmark is a really alcohol is big business in Denmark, and we have to remember it's an alcohol producing country.
Carlsberg,
Tuborg. This is big business over here. I don't know how many Swedish manufacturers of alcohol there are. It's not a major export, at least.
Nah, I don't think so. We have Krebs, but I don't know how big they are.
It's not the same. So, I mean, over here, it's really a defined part of their culture. And one of the things that thankfully actually has been getting a lot better in Denmark, teen drinking has gone down throughout the years, which is very positive. There's a lot less alcohol related accidents that occur with teens, etc. So I think it's become less cool to go out and get hammered like it used to be.
So in Denmark, you started with music business. You want to talk about that a little bit?
So I dropped out of high school. That's the short story. I dropped out of high school. The backstory very quickly. The backstory is that my dad was a drug addict, and I left my house very early. I was 16 when I moved out, and I didn't really have too many options in terms of I didn't really know how to do anything to make money, but I did know how to rap. And so
that come from? You were listening a lot.
Yeah, I knew how to. It was just one of those
you're
skills.
You're from America, so you have the
language. We would play around. So I knew how to rap, and I could make a little bit of money, like maybe 500 kronas here, 1,000 kronas there, battle somebody here, just at parties or whatever. So I would do it in order to make a little bit of money. And then one day, just randomly in the city, I met a very famous Danish DJ called DJ Noise, together with another very famous DJ called DJ Typhoon. And that day when I met them, they actually took me on the radio, like the Danish national radio, the same day. So I went from just being on the street pretty much doing nothing to then freestyling on Danish national radio and then getting a network within music. And then, I met a lot of really great people and they provided me some opportunities and I took them.
And then you started to have your own record company or you had your own studios?
Started out with my own record company. This was back when people would weren't able to get signed to major label deals, for those who know anything about the music industry. So I started my own label. I distributed my own records. I got distribution with other big record companies, signed my own artists, and then eventually opened up music studios. Mm-hmm. That's the number one expense in order to do music, was actually to record the music. Mm-hmm. So I just figured that I would just open music studios and have other people record and make that money, mm-hmm. and then fund it.
Today you have started Guerrilla Media,
yeah.
and you're into social media.
Mm-hmm.
How did that transformation
yeah.
go from music into social media?
So it actually occurred very naturally. I was very blessed to be a part of that generation of the first people who were on social media. That yeah. was MySpace.
Mm.
And MySpace was the place where musicians exactly. would learn how to make money and sell their product and create fan bases.
Yeah.
No major companies were on social media. The term social media wasn't even coined at the time.
Exactly.
So what occurred was that I learned how to produce video, like our own music videos and interview videos. I learned how to distribute them digitally, and I learned the very intricate details about how people act and react on social media.
Mm.
So then when Facebook came into play, we dominated Facebook.
Mm.
I mean, I absolutely knew how to do. I mean, I can read Facebook. I know it's like an intuition now. I can just go on it and touch it. It's it's like it's about become this matrix for me to play with. And so then I took the transition when I converted to Islam in 2014. I also decided the same year that I would no longer do music. And so there was like a period of time where it's like, okay, what do I do next? And it just came to me, it's just social media. I'm going to go into that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And then from social media, I was doing that for 2 years. I did it very successfully. And then I would get clients, big clients. I was working with Marc Jacobs. I was working with 7-Eleven. Mm-hmm. I was working with a lot of different major brands. And they would come to me and say, well, how do we do this? What campaign do we make here? How do we tweak our campaigns? And
mm-hmm.
I would give them either critique their campaigns or build their campaigns. And then I realized there that because the stuff I would do for them was some of the best that they've ever been able to accomplish in terms of numbers. So that advertising and actually creating those campaigns was really my bigger purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started Guerrilla.
And then you came into Danish politics, you could say, or the Danish discourse about foreigners and immigrants.
Mm.
You made this viral video,
yeah,
where your daughter Scarlett
mm.
is, and I saw that video. It was very touching, and I could relate to that.
Mm.
And as a dad, I'm also concerned about my kids,
mm.
Because they're growing up in Sweden, and they're not. People don't ask them. If they're Swedish, the question is, where's your dad from? What's your identity? So mm-hmm. so this is something that concerns me. And, you know, to be a Muslim, you're not part of this society.
Mm.
So you made this video. It went viral. You had a couple of kids. I'm going to also maybe have it here on the pod.
Sure.
So they can hear it.
Jeg hedder Abde, og jeg er 11 år. Jeg hedder Sara, og jeg er 9 år.
Jeg hedder Radin, og jeg er 9 år.
Jeg hedder Scarlett, og jeg er 7 år.
Hvor kommer du fra?
Danmark.
Jeg kommer fra Danmark.
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 Er du sikker?
Ja.
Hvorfor?
Fordi jeg er født i Danmark.
Fordi jeg er blevet født i Danmark, og jeg er vokset op her.
Fordi jeg blev født i Danmark.
Jeg blev opvokset derhen, og jeg kan godt lide Danmark. Og det er sjovt at være derhen.
Nej. Du er ikke dansk.
Hvorfor ikke?
Man kan ikke sige, at hvis man henter hele verden til Danmark, og at de så får nogle børn i Danmark, så bliver de børn danske.
Hvorfor ikke?
And it went viral. You want to tell us a little bit about the backstory?
Definitely, definitely. The video you're referring to is called I Am Danish, hashtag I Am Danish, if anybody wants to see it or find it online. Basically, what occurred was I was... I had Guerrilla Media opened at the time. Guerrilla wasn't active as a company. And we were involved with a lot of... I was involved with a lot of stand-up comedy at the time.
Yeah.
And everywhere I would go, people were joking around with this new Danish law that came out that said... That basically said that if you're not white, if you're not a Western white person, you can't be considered Danish. That was what it insinuated in this law. And it was in Parliament, it was voted in, and people were making fun of it. People who were adopted would tell me, like, yeah, I'm no longer Danish now. Woo, it's really great. And I took it to heart. It bothers me. Because, again, like, I never was questioned about being an American.
Yeah.
Even though I was never American.
Illegal immigrant.
And yeah, I was an illegal immigrant. And I've seen my daughter be questioned about her Danishness.
Mm.
And she's Danish. I mean, she's culturally, I mean, that's her, she's as Danish as you can get.
Yeah.
So it bugged me. It really bugged me. And so I went and thought about how I was going to address this issue.
Yeah.
And then I did the video. I did it on a shoestring budget. I just invited some of the kids that I know. I took my own daughter. I asked the production company to work on it for free. We shot it. I think I planned it on Saturday. We shot it on Sunday. It came out on Tuesday.
And it went viral pretty fast.
I mean, it was one of the most viral videos in Danish history.
Yeah.
Definitely the most viral ever done by a individual company.
Did you think...
Like, that's independent like we are.
Did you think it was going to go viral?
Not at all. We had a goal that said 200,000 views. That would be our goal.
That's pretty high goal. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
200,000 views was our goal. We were like, and if it would go 500,000, it would be crazy. That would be really crazy. And when I put it out, I think we achieved.
How did you put it out? Did you just put it on Facebook?
Just at work. I was at work. It was 10 o'clock, and then on a Tuesday, and I just released it.
Okay.
And we're talking. By the time my work ended, so it was 10, and I was done at 3. The video had already gotten maybe 300,000 views.
Whoa.
And then I went home. I lived pretty far from the city, so I went home, picked up my daughter, made food, had dinner, looked back online again. And it was 800,000 views.
Oh, what did you think?
I thought that's pretty crazy. I was like, wow, this is amazing. And then I went to sleep and woke up at 5:30.
Yeah.
With my phone just ringing.
Yeah.
I mean, my phone was seriously, it was just, I think I had like 40 missed calls. And it was just a barrage of numbers that I didn't recognize.
Yeah.
And I went online and looked, and it was at one point, I think it was like 1.2 million views, and all journalists just calling me from around the world, Sweden, Norway, France, Germany, Chile,
it wasn't
Argentina.
Swedish newspapers.
Oh, yeah,
writing
it was everywhere.
It, yeah,
it
yeah.
was everywhere. I mean, it was insane.
So now when you look back...
Yeah.
What was it about the video that made it go viral like that?
Because we're humanizing it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, people can talk about foreigners and Muslims, and these are all they're great. They're great terms if you want to, you know, dehumanize a population.
Yeah.
But when you're sitting in front of a child and you ask them, "Where do you think you come from?"
And
that person
says,
"Denmark," and then you tell that child, "No, you're not from Denmark." And then you capture that moment where a child then questions their own nationality, ethnicity, their own cultural standing, their own everything. They you can see it in these kids' eyes.
You can see it in their
eyes. It's so
clear. Yeah, I know. And your daughter is part of the...
Yeah.
And she starts to cry.
Starts to cry.
And I feel so sad for her. And, you know, so because it's a very sensitive video. So how did you feel about that? Because
we were sad, man. I mean, I remember. You,
yeah.
I remember she started crying. My partner, Sazen, who was manning the camera, he looked at me and asked if I should turn it off. And I told him, no, you keep that camera rolling.
Yeah.
Because it's a moment. It's an important moment.
Yeah.
You didn't, you know, like when, you know, like let's say that really famous photo with that 13-year-old, 12-year-old girl was naked in front of the tanks. I mean, if the guy he took that picture. He didn't save that girl, you know. Yeah. And you have millions and millions of pictures and videos similar. You know, it's important that the truth is documented.
Yeah.
And this is a moment of truth. This is something that everybody who is a everybody who goes around and is a fear mongerer, everyone who goes around and who considers foreigners not to be of that nationality, they need to see this video. Mm-hmm. They need to understand this video because it's so obvious. And the only criticism that I got was from, first and foremost, was from white people in Denmark who absolutely don't understand what the video was about. Yeah. They would only criticize the use of children, but yet they never criticized the words that was coming out of the government that hurt these children.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So it's a, not to make it into a racial divide, but it was so obvious when you look into the comments about the people who understood and the people who didn't understand this message.
So what kind of effect did it have in the Danish society?
I mean, first and foremost, it's if you were to look at it from a cultural standpoint, that's where a line was drawn in the sand. Mm. Because now everyone in Denmark, it was like 90% of Danish society was exposed to this video.
Yeah.
And this video is still used to this day in institutions to talk about racism, nationalism, bullying with ethnicity and such. So it stands. It's a moment in time that was captured here. So I think that's the number one thing that it's really going to do. The parliament had to go back and re-vote on it, so we forced them to do that.
Wow.
I think they did it twice. We forced all the big Danish politicians to react to the video. Inger Støjberg, who's the old Ministry of Integration, if you could call her that, had to react to it. All of the major politicians on both sides, everyone had to react to this video. This was not a video that could be...
It was a huge impact.
Yeah, I mean, people couldn't keep this one quiet.
Yeah,
no matter what they tried. And their spin doctors really tried. There was no way. Mm. Yeah.
Last time I was here, I interviewed some Danish Muslims, and at that time we had this guy who was going around in Denmark, a politician who was burning the Quran and trying to do different things, you know, and provoke people, and he was trying to get into parliament. And I you know, he popped up on my social media feeds, you know, where he was burning the Quran, he was throwing it around, it was very provocative.
Astaghfirullah.
But then you came from nowhere with a video number two, for me at least, where you interviewed this politician's brother, and his brother was like, don't listen to my brother, he's doing wrong and all this stuff. And a lot of people were afraid that this lunatic was going to get into parliament.
This lunatic was going to get into parliament.
Yeah.
He was. His name is Rasmus Paludan. And Rasmus, he's been on my radar for many years now. It's only recently that he came into mainstream Denmark. I've been watching this guy now for maybe the last two and a half years.
Yeah.
And it's a movement. It's this neo-national Nazi, but they don't call themselves Nazis, but they are. Mm. That's what they are. And it's frightening. It was frightening to begin with that something like this, this level of hate, because believe me, what you're talking about, like everything that we're discussing with this guy is very, very, how do I say it? It's just I'm just not going to talk about what the amount of stuff that he does. He's very disrespectful to Muslims, to foreigners, to Islam, etc. And in and of itself, I don't have a problem with, because people, if somebody wants to burn the Quran, burn the Quran. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but he does it in like Muslim neighborhoods.
But I mean, and
with
even,
police protection and everything.
and even there, it's like, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it. And and I don't have an issue with it, because it's your freedom of speech if you want to do it in that way.
Yeah.
But what occurred was that Rasmus suddenly became very popular because mainstream media gave him attention.
Yeah, yeah.
And Muslims reacted to that. And of course, every time a Muslim, if somebody slips on a banana peel, it's like an act of terrorism in this country. So then suddenly it's mainstream media everywhere. And this guy was able to run for parliament, which then gave him the chance to be on every national debate. And he was garnering tens of thousands of votes. And we were sitting here in our office very concerned about this, because one thing is one crazy guy being able to get some, you know, attention on YouTube. But as soon as you're a part of the national discussion, when the floodgates open, there's no going back. When there was this very, like, there was a nice, like, moment of silence in the press. And then we released it. And we could see on the Vox meter, there's this, like, Vox meter that measures the popularity of the parties and the individuals every week up to the election. And from when the video came out in that week, which nothing else happened, he had a 30% decrease in interest from potential voters. And when he finally, he lost the election, he was not able to come into parliament. I think it was with like 0.2%, maybe it was like 10,000, 20,000 people away from achieving it. He actually went on national TV and blamed us. He called us he called us a Muslim communications bureau who used his brother as a pawn. And blamed us and blamed his brother for the loss, which I thought was just, I mean, I've won a lot of awards at Guerrilla Media. We're at 78 awards right now, but nothing made me feel better than that
comment.
10-second clip. I loved it. Yeah.
You know, now when we talk about these videos, because you've taken part of the Danish political discourse. Now, as a, you know, business person, some businesses are like, you know, we shouldn't get into politics. We should just do our business. You know, it's sensitive. If we go out and do these political things, then maybe companies don't want to cooperate with us. You know, business people think a little bit like that. How do you think about it when you...
I mean, I always just thought to myself, I mean, it's the chances of us going, we're a startup company. The chances of going bankrupt is pretty much like 95%, isn't it? Isn't it the statistics? So chances are we're going to go bankrupt anyway. We might as well go out with a bang, right?
Yeah.
So is that responsible to say as a Muslim these days? Am I allowed to make that joke?
Everything's
but
okay.
It's so, I mean, yeah, of course, it's one of those things that you think about. And I think that I would be ignorant if I said that it probably hasn't affected business. There's some companies that are not going to work with us. But those companies don't match my DNA to begin with. I like to make controversial material. I like to make material that creates change. I am Muslim. Our office is international. We have people from all over the world, Muslims included. So if a person's not going to work with Guerrilla Media, they're not going to work with us. But at the end of the day, when you look at the results that we make, companies look at that. That's what they care about at the end of the day, right? They care about the results. And I mean, it's not that, you know, it's not that we're still a production company. We're still an advertising agency. So unfortunately, you know, I also have to make a lot of other types of products I'm not that proud of, but you know.
How's the positive effects been from these two videos for Guerrilla Media? I mean, that's how I found out about Guerrilla Media, and I think a lot of people.
Positive effects is the actual thing that we were combating. So I Am Danish was positive because it put this ethnicity and being Danish in the forefront. The other video, the positive thing was, well, of course, it stopped Rasmus Paludan from getting into parliament. I don't think it's really affected our business in either a good or a bad way. It gets us some media attention, for whatever that's worth. So
I want to go back to your spiritual journey. You said that you converted to Islam.
I did.
And that what year was that? 2004 or?
That was 2014.
14, yeah.
Yeah, about 5 years ago.
So you want to tell the story up to the conversion and what made
you convert? Yeah, so I was working. This is where I was working with social media. And I was doing research on, I had a client from Dubai. And I was a little bit uncertain about the rules about social media ads in Muslim countries, what you could or what you couldn't do.
Yeah.
So I was just doing some like random research online, and I found a Mufti Menk video discussing social media and Islam.
Yeah.
And I remember looking at the thumbnail and just thinking, look at this terrorist looking guy, like it's going to be interesting. So I click in on it, and then I hear his it's a 1 hour speech on social media and Islam. And what struck me right away was that he sounded, one, he's very, like, he has a very, very nice etiquette, and his mannerisms and everything is really beautiful. But he sounds a lot like one of my very best friends, Hatem. Okay. So I was instantly drawn to his voice, and then I heard the video. I actually learned quite a lot from the video, and then the video auto-plays. It's YouTube, right? It auto-plays into the next one. And the next video was... What have you know? Where are you with your life? Where are you headed?
With Mufti Menk.
With Mufti Menk. Okay. And then I heard it. And that was the first real epiphany about, wow, this is something that I need to pay attention to.
That's one of my wife's favorite lecturers. She always listens to him during the weekends, especially. Yeah. He's like on. So
yeah. I listened to Mufti Menk from there on out. I think I started listening to one or two lectures a day because he has just so much material out there. And his message was very clear. His message was very pure. And I was kind of going around for maybe like 6 months, really studying the religion on my own free time. And then I get a phone call very randomly one day from one of my old artists called Faraz. And without throwing the brother under the bus, Faraz was definitely the last guy who I would ever consider would, number one, call me or call me with what he asked me, which was, he said, Alex, I need to ask you a favor. I need you to remove all my music from the internet, from all the streaming sites, remove my videos and off YouTube. And I asked him why, and he told me that he had converted to Islam. And this was the last human being. I'm telling you, he's the last person you would ever imagine. Party animal, damn near alcoholic. It was, I mean, I would never have expected. Then I told him on the phone, I was like, that's incredible that you're making this phone call. Because, you know, for the last 6 months, I've been myself considering to convert to Islam. And he was telling me, was like, are you serious? He was like, I've been waiting 3 months to try to, like, every day to try to get the courage to call you because I thought that you would laugh at me. I thought that you would put me down. And then we had a great conversation, and then it ended up being, he was living in this city about an hour and a half away called Ulanza, and he ends up saying, are you ready to convert today? I said, I'll convert right now. Let's go. So he took the train over, and we were at Maghrib prayer at the big mosque here in Copenhagen, and that's where I took my shahada. Same day. Yeah, it was amazing.
Incredible story.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
So how's it, you know, that was 2014 and that was like 2019. How's been your journey, spiritual journey on that path? It's been like, what, 5 years or something?
It's been very interesting. I guess like all people who convert into a religion, I dove into Islam. I really tried my best to learn as much as I could. And that takes you into a lot of very strange places online with the Islamic community. I'm sure everybody knows
Sheikh Google, you know?
Well, but you know, you'd be surprised. Sheikh Google refers to a lot of well-known sheikhs,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you can go around and you can get a lot of information.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's a wealth of information that's available to you. I mean, it's an incredible library of opinions and thoughts. So at first, I think I was very cautious.
Yeah.
I was very confused. I realized that Islam has pretty much no tools for any convert, right? You still can't find, this is just an example, you'll never find one video that will just show you the absolute bare minimum of what you're supposed to do, right?
Yeah.
It'll always, everything will tell you the extras, the additionals. Nobody will just give you like, okay, what's the actual bare, right? Because so while I was struggling to learn like Quranic verses, nobody told me, hey, all you actually need to learn is Fatiha and just repeat that over and over again.
Yeah.
And that's technically enough to do your salah.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And so it was like I saw there's a lot of miscommunication.
Yeah.
And then my journey into Islam basically also really started where now I understood that community. And I could so clearly see the miscommunication that's occurring between Western society and the Muslim communities and Muslim societies. So
that's your field, communication.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a beautiful place. Islam, in its purest form, is very open. Somebody I heard a quote from one of the sheikhs, and he said that Islam is never scared of innovation or criticism. It's only Muslims that are, right? And I realize that because, like, you know, even to this day, I still can't have certain discussions with people or else before you get thrown under, like, it's apostasy, leave him alone, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's where I am today with it, alhamdulillah. I do my very best. I read the Quran. I pray as many times as I can. I pay my zakat. I fast Ramadan. Hopefully I get to go to Hajj as soon as possible. And I'm continue. I try to reflect it in my daily life, right? And
it reminds me of a story when a person came to the Prophet. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon him. And he said, tell me what's the minimum. He told him these things that you're telling me. And sometimes we Muslims complicate the religion, actually. So that's where I think you're coming to, that Muslims are making it complicated.
There's a hadith where the man is sitting in front of the Prophet, and peace be upon him, and says that, I can't pray my five prayers. And he's like, well, do your Fajr and Asr. And if you can't do it, do your Asr. Right, so it's like, but if you were to go to a sheikh today and say, brother, I can't do my five prayers, what's the response that you're going to get? Astaghfirullah. You have to do your five. If you don't do your five, you know, but then you can go into the books.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no excuse. As Muslims, we know that we have to pray, of course.
Yeah, of course.
And inshallah, we all get there. Yeah. Inshallah, we all get there. But no amount of prayer is still going to make you into a better person. I mean, you know. Yeah. It's also understanding that you live Islam with all the things that you do, your interactions with your family, your interactions with your colleagues, how you are out and about, how do you treat nature? These are all things that also count, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a holistic thing. I bet that's what I came to the conclusion. It's holistic.
I know that we're coming to the end here, but I would love to hear your story about the TED Talk. I listened to it. I saw it on YouTube, and it touched me very deeply.
Thank you.
And you know, as a father, you think about your kids and everything. And I really recommend all the listeners to watch that YouTube clip. I'm gonna put a link on the show notes as well. So would you like to just give the background without maybe giving all the details so the listeners can watch it themselves? It's just a couple of minutes, but it's a TED Talk, and it's very inspiring.
Yeah. Well, the TED Talk is about it's about appreciation.
Yeah.
Just for a short backstory, I lost a son, my son Adam, in 2018. He was 3 months old, and it was everything kind of crashed in one place.
Yeah.
And the TEDx really goes together with that. So yeah, I don't know what I don't know what to say more than that.
I really love that video, and it's very powerful, and I want everybody to see it. So so a real reminder, you know, in life, what's important in life.
I think that for Muslims and non-Muslims alike, I think that it's a beneficial kind of reminder.
Yeah.
I definitely it's definitely something that I do. I mean, I come with some concrete things that a person should do in this TED talk that helped me, at least in my moment.
Mm.
And still to this day, it's one of those things that, I mean, it for the purpose, because TED is, of course, it's a world platform. So I'm speaking to also a lot of non-Muslims. In that case, it's, you know, when we talk about this appreciation exercise, that's what you would tell non-Muslims. But to Muslims, it's just, if you wake up every morning in a state of being thankful to God, really, then that's the best way of being able to stay in line. But I mean, Adam, I've lost two sons in the last few years. I lost my son Theodore in 2016, and I lost Adam in 2018. And what I do want to like share, I brought my Quran with me here as well, was this story that for me was the most profound experience I've ever had with the Quran. And shout out to Isam B, who you're going to be interviewing, who told me many times that, you know, just skim through the Quran and the Quran will just give you the answer. And I remembered him telling me that, like, this Quran that I have here is a Quran that I've had. I don't know who gave it to me.
It looks kind of old.
It is very old. I've had
it's
it
beautiful.
I've had it since I was a kid. I do remember when I came to Denmark, I had it with me. So I assume that it was given to me by my mother or my grandmother or somebody. I've never, like, opened this Quran, because I have a new Sahih International one that was given to me when I converted. Shout out to the big mosque. So I never opened this Quran. And when I was sitting there, I needed to, like, I wanted to say some words at my son's funeral. I needed to say something. So I was looking, I couldn't find my Sahih International Quran. So I dug this Quran up. Now, this Quran, I'm telling you, I've never opened this Quran. I've never read this Quran. It's the Abdullah Yusuf Ali Quran. So it's also the wording is very complicated.
Compared
to the Sahih International one. And I've moved, I've traveled through multiple countries. In Denmark, I've traveled at least 20 times. Like,
you always have
moved.
That with you.
I've always, for whatever reason, had this Quran with me.
SubhanAllah.
So then what I started doing was I was just skimming the Quran like I would do in this way, right? Trying to find a particular passage that made sense to me to be able to read. Because I don't know the Quran at that point. Let me try to find it here. Now, you see this? Okay. For the listeners out there, one page when I was flipping through the Quran...
It has like a... They call it dog ear, right?
It had a crease in it. It was where the page was folded down. Like, as in to hold a place.
Top and corner.
The top corner.
Folded.
And for all of the people at home... I'll put the particular
I can put
up.
The reference.
And for whatever reason, and believe it or not, it's the only verse of the Quran that talks about children dying.
SubhanAllah.
Ya ayyuhan nas in kuntum fi raybin min al-ba'th fa inna khalaqnakum min turab فَإِنَّا خَلَقْنَاكُمْ مِنْ تُرَابٍ ثُمَّ مِنْ نُطْفَةٍ ثُمَّ مِنْ عَلَقَةٍ ثُمَّ مِنْ مُضْغَةٍ مُخَلَّقَةٍ وَغَيْرِ مُخَلَّقَةٍ لِنُبَيِّنَ لَكُمْ ونقر في الأرحام ما نشاء إلى أجل مسمى ثم نخرجكم طفلا ثم لتبلغوا أشدكم ومنكم من يتوفى ومنكم من يرد إلى أرذل العمر لكي لا يعلم من بعد علم شيئا.
O mankind, if you have a doubt about the resurrection, consider that we created you out of dust, then out of sperm, then out of a leech-like cloth, and then out of a morsel of flesh, partly formed, partly unformed, in order that we may manifest to you, and we cause whom we will to rest in the wombs for an appointed term. Then do we bring you out as babies, then foster you, that ye may reach your age of full strength. And some of you are called to die, and some are sent back to the feeblest of old age, so they know nothing after having knowing much. And so, and then it ends with, this is because Allah is the reality. It's He who gives life to the dead, and it's He who has power over all things. And
so when you read that the first time, you're going through the Quran and you see that the top corner is, and nobody knows who did that top corner thing.
Listen, I've never had this Quran opened before. I randomly skimmed through it and looking for a verse to say during my son's funeral. And that was the one that found me. And I started weeping because this was my reminder that God was with me. And some might call it a coincidence, but the Quran is such a intricate book and it's a pretty crazy coincidence. I mean, if you ask me,
I don't believe in coincidences.
Neither do I.
During these years and thinking about things, I have a friend that also lost kids, and we know that Prophet Muhammad SAW also lost some of his kids at a very, very young age, you know, and it's recorded that he cried, and people, you know, asked him, why do you cry, you know, and he said that's of love, you know, that he was crying for his son that he lost. But there's also this beautiful hadith of, you know, if you have patience with this trial, that on the day of judgment, those little kids will take their parents by their hands and take them into Jannah, which is such a beautiful image, you know, the kids coming, taking their parents by their hands, you know, and leading them to Jannah. So I pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He will reunite you with your lost kids, inshallah, and that they will take you by your hand and lead you into Jannah, inshallah. So, I mean,
so, no, it was an eye opener, and after reading that, I felt hope.
Yeah,
and it's a very, I don't think anything could have given me hope, but that did.
Yeah,
and it's definitely something that tests your spirituality. Of course, you struggle with deen afterwards. It's very, very hard to come back in the same way that you were before, because it's just there's a level of pain that's inside you that there didn't exist before.
Yeah.
So you become, you know, a lot more self-destructive. You become a lot more just willing to take chances, considering. But subhanAllah, it's also something that's been giving me a lot of strength, and it's an eye-opener. Especially the way he passed, the way Adam passed. It was an eye-opener about, number one, how fragile this really is, how fragile the life that we live is, and it completely changed my focus. So where before Adam, I was very much fixated on success in this world,
or making money and being able to do things. It's completely 100% escaped me now, where I just don't care about the material. I don't care about the showing off. It completely changed my focus. So I only pray and I really hope that I have the opportunity to have continued success, and then to use that success in order to better the community and the local as well as global community that's around me. Mm-hmm. And that was a blessing. That was a blessing. That's what Adam gave me. That's what Theodore gave me. And so for that, yeah, I'm very thankful.
I really, want to tell the listeners to watch that TED Talk. And Alex, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For sharing your stories. It's been very inspiring for me.
Thank you very
and
much.
And I know it will be for my listeners also.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And for having us in your beautiful, inspiring office.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I wish you the best. And if you come to Malmo, you have a brother over there. You want to have a cup of coffee, tea, whatever. You're always welcome.
There it is, bro. I'm definitely much. Ready.
Really appreciate this.
I love Malmo. I love going to Sweden. I lived in Stockholm for 2 years, so it's a great place.
We need to meet each other and talk about Stockholm.
Definitely.
So, inshallah. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, bro. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Tack för att du lyssnade på mitt samtal med Alex. Något som jag tar med mig från detta samtal är vilken inre styrka och övertygelse på Guds existens som Alex har fastän han har förlorat 2 barn. Det är verkligen inspirerande och ingjuter hos mig en stor respekt för Alex. Vad tar du själv med dig från detta samtal? Jag är nyfiken på att få veta. Lämna ett svar eller en kommentar direkt på vår hemsida. Gå in på koranpodden.se/111 och lämna din kommentar längst ner på sidan. Du kan också maila mig dina tankar direkt på hej@koranpodden.se. I nästa veckas avsnitt, poddavsnitt 112, är det premiär för poddradioserien Guds öppna bok med Sema Ekinji. Sema Ekinji har vi ett flertal gånger gästat Sveriges Radios morgonandakter. Lyssna gärna på hennes morgonandakter, du kommer inte ångra dig. Väldigt inspirerande och upplyftande. Jag ser verkligen fram emot hennes poddradioserie här på Koranpodden i 3 avsnitt. Och jag hoppas att du också gör det. Här kommer ett kort utdrag från hennes serie Guds öppna bok.
Under de år som jag undervisat i ämnet biologi möter jag i kursböckerna förr eller senare en person som lämnat ett särskilt avtryck i den vetenskapliga världen. Det är ingen mindre än Carl von Linné, vars insats förändrade vårt sätt att bygga på kunskaper kring växtriket. Carl von Linnés arbete är fascinerande att studera, men jag finner hans spirituella syn på omvärlden mer fängslande.
Missa definitivt inte Sema Ekinjis poddradioserie Guds öppna bok nu på måndag, inshallah. Glöm inte heller att ladda ner min distanskurs Botemedel mot sorg och ångest som jag nämnde i början av detta avsnitt. Direktlänken till distanskursen hittar du på koranpodden.se/111. Följ oss på Facebook och Instagram för inspirerande och upplyftande korancitat under hela veckan. Och vill du komma i kontakt med mig så gör du det lättast genom att maila mig på hej@koranpodden.se. Då återstår det bara för mig att önska dig en härlig vecka. Tack för att just du lyssnar på Koranpodden. Vi hörs igen nästa vecka på måndag, inshallah. Och fortsätter vi med säsong 3. Ta hand om dig tills dess. Salamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.